Gary versus Brickett, executive, et cetera, James J. Reed, Nicholas A. Newton, Hudson Council, George A. Somerville, Adderley Council.
You may proceed. You may proceed.
I apologize, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Nicholas Nunes. I represent the appellate in this case. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
The subject of this case is two burial plots that belong to Wallace Terry Sr., the decedent in this case. He died in 2002 with a will that was executed in 1998. He died leaving three children, Karen, who's the appellee in this case, the executrix, Johnny and Wallace. Wallace is the appellant who I represent in this case. The burial plots at issue in this case are two. The decedent and his wife used two of the original four. They were purchased in 1972, and they were subject to a sales agreement as well as rules and regulations and bylaws of the cemetery. There doesn't seem to be any contest that those rules and regulations are applicable. The one that we believe is most important here is Rule 24. Rule 24 provides that any devise of these burial plots must be by specific devise. They also provide for an option where one can provide a written direction to the cemetery, similar to what you would see in a POD account or life insurance account where you would identify a beneficiary. If not specifically devised, Rule 24 provides that the burial plots will go to the heirs at law of the decedent, which is what we contest is appropriate here. In this case, the will did not specifically devise those burial rights. The will never addressed those burial rights. The will left Wallace a car. It also referred to an insurance policy. Whether or not the decedent actually had control over that policy, we don't think he did, because that would have been controlled by the beneficiary designation, just like this may have been controlled had he done a written direction to the cemetery before his death. Karen and Johnny were to split the residuary of the estate. Karen was to receive 60% and Johnny to receive 40%. Interestingly enough, the appellees contest that in their brief, the intent of the testator was for Karen and Johnny to be buried with the testator and his wife. But that's not what the executrix actually put into effect. What she has proposed is that she would be the recipient of these two burial plots. That they would argue that there's an intent of the testator for Karen and Johnny to be buried there, and then argue at the same time that those burial plots should be distributed to Karen doesn't seem to jive. Those two things don't make any sense when you put them together. What happened here is Karen apparently wanted to sell or transfer these burial plots, and the cemetery refused to put those plots in her name. The cemetery rejected that attempt. They cited Rule 24 and that this was not specifically devised. They also cited in the alternative that she could obtain a court order from a court of competent jurisdiction, or they called it an order of distribution. It's important to note that the appellee argues that Rule 23 takes precedent over 24. They argue, I guess because it comes before 24, it's more important, or that somehow it overrules Rule 24. But the letter, which is from the cemetery, which is part of the record, clearly states that they could obtain an order of distribution in the alternative. To the cemetery, Rule 24 seems to be the one that takes control as opposed to Rule 23. There's also an argument over what is the true intent of the testator. The appellees believe that in this case, a testator has the right to dispose of his entire estate, and that's absolutely true. And where they do a residuary clause, that is the intent, seems to be the situation. But that comes with a caveat. One can only dispose of their estate to the extent they have power of that disposition and within compliance with any limitations on that power. And here, the testator clearly contracted away some of that power of disposition. He agreed to be bound by the rules of the cemetery, including Rule 24, which required a specific devise. When he chose to not do a specific devise, that was important. The testator is presumed to know of his property. He's presumed to know of his contracts. He's presumed to know, as a party to a contract, he's presumed to know his rights and restrictions under the term of that contract. Thus, the only presumption that could be made in this case is that when Mr. Wallace made his will, he did so knowing he owned those burial rights and chose to not include those burial rights. He did so knowing that it was a specific devise was required if he wanted to have them carried by the will or controlled by the will. He chose not to include those. That choice is important here. Those legal presumptions are important here. None of those are rebutted by any of the facts, by anything in the record. Those things should prevail. On top of that, this case is markedly similar to one recently decided by this court that I think actually bears on an earlier estate case, Jimenez v. Quick. In that case, there was a dispute between a shareholder agreement and a will as to what would happen to shares of stock, which is not drastically dissimilar to this one. The shareholder's agreement specified what would happen to certain shares of stock upon someone's death. In that case, in Jimenez, the will tried to devise those shares of stock via a residuary clause, just like what we have here with these burial rights. The logic and reasoning and law cited in Jimenez is the exact same concept that applies and should control in this case. And the general rule is that where you have a specific provision in another document that relates to disposition of an asset, that will control over the general terms of a will, such as in the residuary clause. We liken it to a right to make a contract to make a will. Oftentimes you see it with blended families. But in this situation, what the testator did was he signed a contract when he purchased those burial plots, and under that he agreed to be limited in the manner in which he would devise those rights.
Is it simplistic to say, for me to say, that this is really not a trust and estates case anyway? It's just a simple contract case, and the testator signed away his rights in a certain way?
It is a contract case to an extent, Your Honor. The limitation is that the other party to the contract, the cemetery, is not a party in this case. They asserted their rights via letter and with Ms. Rickett personally. That ultimately led to all of this. But the contract provisions, just like in Jimenez v. Core, are the ones that really are the heart of the case, I think.
And just like a beneficiary clause in the contract of life insurance.
Correct, Your Honor. That's why we also argue that this is really very similar to a non-probate asset, that it specifically provides in Rule 24 that you can do a written direction to the cemetery that would provide where this asset goes upon your death. What I don't know is what happens if you both do a specific devise and the written direction. I would argue the written direction would prevail because that fits more with the non-probate asset.
Well, if the written direction precedes the will, it clearly would.
I would argue that, yes, Your Honor. If the court has no other questions, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm George Somerville, counsel for the appellee, Karen Terry Rickett. This is not simply a contract case, Your Honor. This is the case. Well, let me go back to Jimenez, again, the case the counsel was discussing. That was a disposition, a testamentary disposition case. The issue, the ultimate issue there, as it should be here, was what was the testator's intent. The testator's intent in that case was derived from two instruments, a will And the shareholders' agreement, and this is important, I think counsel did not mention it, the shareholders' agreement was entered into some years later. In this case, the will came 26 years after the sales contract. But
in the sales contract, he said, I agree that when I die, you give it to my intestate heirs, unless I tell you otherwise really, really clearly.
No, the sale contract did not say that. It simply said it was subject to the rules and regulations of the cemetery and the laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I will come to that point if I have the opportunity.
Well, paragraph 24 says, if I die, it goes to my heirs through intestacy, unless I give a specific devise in the will, or I tell you before I die, in writing, how I want it. I don't see how it's any different from a beneficiary clause in a life insurance policy. It's simply an asset, and you contract away where it goes upon the condition subsequent of your death. And you can't change it by your will because it never enters in the estate to begin with.
Well, I think you have to read Rule 23 and 24 together, Justice Gelson. You can't read either of them as nullifying the other, I submit. And reading them together in peri materia, there are three ways in which a testator can dispose of his unused burial rights: by a written direction to the cemetery, by a specific devise in a will, or by an order of distribution of a court with jurisdiction. That's Rule 23. A court will necessarily enter an order of distribution that is consistent with the testator's intent. If there is any fixed rule of construction of testamentary dispositions in Virginia, it is that courts will strive to give effect to the intent of a testator. Any other reading of Rule 23 would read it out of the rules. That construction is also consistent with a practical and reasonable construction of the statute given by the cemetery.
Why does it read... Why does Rule 23 get read out if he does a specific devise in the will, the cemetery knows if you write a letter saying, you know what, I'm changing this, it's going to be so-and-so who gets it. Well, clearly that gives them notice. They don't necessarily have a will that does a specific devise. So when that happens, the court then enters the order of distribution in accord with the will. And so then the cemetery gets that and says, okay, well, now we're going to update our records. Or if the court in an intestacy says, well, here's your heirs, here's who gets it, then that gets to the cemetery. So why does Rule 23 doesn't effectuate 24 as opposed to a freestanding separate ground?
Well, if there is a specific devise, then the order of distribution will be consistent with the specific devise.
Right.
If there's a written direction in a non-testamentary instrument, we could have a question of a conflict between the Rule 24 and statutory law. Section 64.2-401 provides that any individual, adult who's competent, may make a will to dispose of all or part of his estate at his death that, if not disposed of, would otherwise pass by intestate succession. Now, Rule 24, if it reads out the residuary clause, causes property passed by intestate succession.
No, it causes property to be passed by contract and simply refers to intestate succession as the contractually agreed upon result. It's not putting the intestacy statutes in conflict with trust and estates law.
Well, the appellant's consistent argument has been that this property should pass by intestate succession.
But the power of doing that is the power of the law of contract, not the power of the intestacy statute. That's simply a cross-reference that the contracting parties agreed to.
Well, it's a testamentary disposition case. Whether it's contract, will, or some other non-testamentary instrument, I think you have to go back to the poll star that courts in Virginia, as elsewhere, strive to give effect to a testator's intent. And the intent is not contested.
So one last question, a life insurance policy. And it says, I've accrued all this this asset value in my life insurance policy. And when I die, insurance company, I want you to give it to whoever my heirs are in terminate testacy. Unless I tell you otherwise in the will, or I tell you otherwise before I die. They can't do that?
Depends on who the beneficiary is in the insurance contract. If the beneficiary is...
Let's say it's the intestate heirs, not the beneficiaries under a testamentary instrument.
Well, if the beneficiary is the testator's estate, is that your question, Your Honor?
No, consider this burial plot contract as a life insurance policy. There's an asset. A bunch of money is in a vault somewhere, figuratively speaking, in an insurance company. And when you die, you agree with the insurance company, I don't want it to go to my estate. I want it to go to my dog. I want it to go to Union Mission. I want it to go to... No, let's say I want it to go to whoever my heirs are under the intestacy statute. Why couldn't people contractually agree to that?
That is a pure contract question under insurance law. Typically, an insurance contract will say who is the beneficiary at death. It may provide, typically does, for a written direction from the owner of the contract to change the beneficiary.
But my question is, why isn't it a pure contract question under contract law? And this is a contract.
Because here we have a will with residuary clause, and you are required to decide, does that residuary clause include the burial rights? And the argument that appellate is making is, as I understand it, no, that's been contracted away. And I think, again, you have to read the rules. And there's no...
Okay, but if we read Rule 23 as an alternative to Rule 24, that's what you want.
Well,
it provides a third way. Then that... Right,
yeah.
Right. So then that means the interment rights could also be given to someone who is not an heir of law, period.
Yes, but, you know, if they want to be given to the testator's church in his will, he can do that under Rule 23. Rule 23 says if the intent of the will of the testator is to leave two plots to the church and a commissioner of accounts so finds and a circuit court confirms that that's the intent, then that's where those two plots should go.
Then why have Rule 24 at all? Why didn't the contract say, we're not agreeing on who it should go to, we'll just whatever the court says, that's what we're agreeing to?
I'm sorry, Justice Kelsey, I don't hear like I used to.
If what you're saying about Rule 23 is correct, why is 24 in the document at all? Because 23 would just be, we're not making any agreement as to who gets this. We'll just let it go into the estate, and whoever the judge says it goes to, it goes to.
Because they address three different situations. A specific devise, a written direction given presumably before the testator's death, and if neither of those is in existence, then somebody goes, as the cemetery's managing agent told Karen's attorney, get an order of distribution, and we will honor that. That's a reasonable and practical construction of that rule that the circuit court and the commissioner of counts accepted, and appellant's asking you to reject that. And I think if it is a pure contract case, Justice Kelsey, you have to say there is some ambiguity here. How do these two rules interact? The cemetery's managing agent has said this is how they interact.
Well,
you
they're not before the court. The party that's before the court says, I don't care what the cemetery thought. We didn't think that, and the language doesn't say it.
I'm sorry.
The argument that course of performance, which is a great argument to understand ambiguities, involves course of performance by the party, not, in this case, an entity that's a party to the contract but not party to the litigation.
Yes. I think I have covered everything that I needed to cover, Your Honor. If there are any further questions, I'll be glad to take them.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Very briefly, the appellee seems to argue that 23, or not seems to, they do argue that 23 should work to prevail over 24, that they can't operate simultaneously in the same set of rules. What they want 23 to do is effectively be used as a way to nullify Rule 24. They seem to think that if we just get a court order, then we can ignore Rule 24 and 24 doesn't matter at all. We read Rule 23 as the cemetery basically saying, if you have a court order, we will obey it. That doesn't seem to be a pretty drastic sort of stance to take when you say, you have a court order that says it's yours, okay.
Well, I know the parties look at the first clause of Rule 20, operative clause of Rule 23, but I read that as dealing with chiefly with records. We have to know who is entitled to this plot. So you look at Rule 22, it says, look, write to us and tell us, okay, you don't want to be buried here, you want your, you know, wife, cousin, best friend, whatever, and we'll honor that. So just tell us so we know. We don't want to put the wrong person in the ground, because that's a big headache if we do that, right? So then Rule 23 says, okay, well, so if you haven't notified us in writing and you get a court order because you specifically devised, you know, to somebody else, or you've gone through intestacy or whatever, all right, now we know who is your heir, well, tell us so we can update our records and make sure the right, you know, we don't make a mistake that causes litigation and headaches. So it seems like 23 isn't so much saying, well, court, do whatever you please. It's saying, the heart of it to me was, if you're not going to tell us in writing before you die, give us the court order that says who is entitled to do it, and then we can update our records. So the emphasis to me was more on the records point than the alternative for, well, as long as the court tells. And, of course, practically speaking, what are they going to do, be held in contempt? I mean, even if the court order is wrong, of course, I would think they'd want to obey it. So, at any rate, that's not really a question.
To answer the question, Your Honor, I think that was an eloquent.
Okay.
One thing the appellant said is that this is a testamentary disposition case. To the extent it is, this is one where that disposition was not done in compliance with the contract that he signed. That's the same sort of disposition that was upheld, or was actually ruled to not have been effective in Jimenez, where they argue that Jimenez, the court found that there was intent found in more than just the will. It was found in the shareholder agreement and the will. I don't see how this case is any different. The intent of the testator as to these burial plots is found in both the will, to the extent it's subject to the residuary clause or any specific devise, and more importantly, the cemetery contract, which carries with it the bylaws, rules, and regulations. If there are no further questions, we would rest.
All right, thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 11:15.
All rise.